Hello, I'm Esther Booksbaum. This is number 0352, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0352. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Stephen Thomas, who has a unique hobby. He collects and often tastes vintage military rations. No, seriously, how did this become a thing?
It was a fascination that started when I was a kid. I always loved military stuff, and then I got into the whole military ration thing when I was, 8 years old. My dad came home from an Army and Navy store. He stopped that with my uncle, and he picked up a case of MREs, and I've been pretty much in love ever since. You know, I've just been buying these things for most of my life here, and I collect and occasionally document the opening and reviewing and occasional taste testing of various military rations.
Michael Perry is the author of the novel, The Jesus Cow.
Many years ago, I used to do some writing in a coffee shop in Nashville, Tennessee. When you went to pay for your coffee, there in a tiny little illuminated shrine beside the cash register was a cinnamon bun that was said to resemble the face of Mother Teresa. It did kind of look like Mother Teresa, although it helped if you knew ahead of time. And they called it the Nun Bun, and they sold Nun Bun t-shirts and coffee mugs. I got fascinated with the idea of what would happen if a guy in a small town had a cow that on Christmas Eve night had a little calf, and the spots on the side of the calf could be construed to be the image of Christ.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. This time, Book Banter goes to the Great White Way and explores 50 years of Broadway history in Razzle Dazzle. Their curtain rises very soon on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0352 was Esther Booksbaum, president and co-founder of Energy PR right here in Montreal. And you can follow the link on my website for the What's On page for this show, which will take you to Energy PR. And if you want to know the show that we're talking about, it's the one Esther just mentioned, number 0352. Thank you very much, Esther, for doing this week's edition of the Stuff File program slate. Much appreciated. You know, Esther is one of the sweetest human beings on the entire planet. I kid you not. Anyway, again, thank you, Esther, for doing the slate on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Authorities in Florida said a man accidentally shot himself while cleaning his gun and didn't notice the wound until he changed his shirt 2 days later. The Volusia County Sheriff's Office said deputies responded to a report of a shooting victim at Florida Hospital Fish Memorial, and they spoke with Deltona resident 37-year-old Michael Blevins, who had checked himself into the hospital with a bullet wound. Blevins told deputies he was cleaning his .22 caliber pistol on Thursday in the living room of his home, and he was holding the gun close to his chest to prevent his dog from jumping near it. The man said he felt a sharp pain in his back from a previous injury, and when he tried to stand up, the gun fired. He said he did not believe the bullet had struck him until Saturday, when he removed his long-sleeve black shirt and discovered the bullet's entry and exit wounds on his arm. Blevins said the medication he takes for his back injury may have prevented him from feeling any pain from the gunshot. Okay, that might be all fine and dandy, but it's not my biggest concern in this story. What I'd like to know is, who goes over 2 days without ever taking off their shirt? And was he never near a mirror or anything to catch a glimpse of perhaps the dried blood? I know he had a black shirt on, but still, blood dries darker. Unless he just wears a dirty shirt, which if you keep it on for 2 days straight, kind of answers that question. This story just seems to be a tad weird. Anyway, moving right along, the Tobacco Road store in Owensboro, Kentucky, has money problems, says manager Cindy Collins, some of the customers like to bring me soggy money. Soggy? Yeah, they dig deep into their not-so-called pockets to bring me some nasty money that we don't want to accept anymore. She said most customers give them money from their wallets or purses, but others will reach into their shoes, socks, or bras to retrieve cash. Money is nasty anyway, but we don't want to accept money that's sweaty or normally in places you wouldn't put money at. The store now has a sign on the door saying cashiers will no longer be accepting boob or sock money. The sign has actually increased business. People are coming into the store to read the sign and take pictures. Well, that's tit for tat, isn't it? Yes. An Ivy League professor aboard an American Airlines flight was questioned after a passenger mistook a math equation for Arabic and possible Islamic code for a terrorist attack. A blonde-haired woman in her 30s wearing flip-flops, and apparently with a fifth-grade education, passed a note to a flight attendant. Guido Menzio, an economics professor at the University of Pennsylvania, was working on a differential math equation as the Syracuse-bound plane was preparing to take off from Philadelphia. The 41-minute flight was delayed for 2 hours as the olive-skinned, curly, dark-haired Native Italian, was questioned. After realizing he was only doing math, the flight took off with Menzio on board, but minus the complaining passenger. The woman boarded a later flight for Syracuse. In a Facebook post, Menzio wrote, "The woman just looked at me, looked at my writing of mysterious formulae, and concluded I was up to no good. Because of that, an entire flight was delayed." Well. Apparently, for some people, math is a real terror. And I know I have reached a certain age where I'm beginning to sound like an old fogey, but there was a time when people used to dress properly to take a flight. It's not like this plane was going to a beach resort. It was going to Syracuse. Put on some real shoes instead of flip-flops. And full disclosure, I have to confess that there are few sounds on this planet I find more annoying than the slap, slap, slap of flip-flops. I could just imagine listening to her coming from miles across the tile floor at the airport concourse. Lovely. Just lovely. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Salah Abdel Sadiq, head of Egypt's State Information Service, has identified the source of the violence and extremism in the Arab world. At the Media and Culture of Violence conference at Cairo University, he explained that TV is to blame, specifically Tom and Jerry cartoons, which condone violence and other bad habits for the viewers. He said video games also contribute to the problem by normalizing violence for those who play them. However, Amir Adli, vice president of Cairo University for Higher Studies and Research Affairs, said that there are bigger reasons behind the trend, such as a lack of attention to the issue in the country's laws. Yeah, maybe this can only be settled by mousetraps and high explosives. Yeah. Well, you know, that first guy actually might have a point, now that I think about it. I mean, I grew up in the 60s when Tom and Jerry was on every Saturday. Those were the days of major battles in the civil rights movement, riots at the 68 Democratic Convention, the Manson murders, just to name a few. I mean, my God, why didn't we lock up Hanna-Barbera when we had the chance? They were just animation terrorists, weren't they? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? There is a growing group of people out there who are fond and curious about K-rations, or MREs. Those are the meals military personnel lived on in the theaters of war. You can go online on YouTube and watch people opening and, yes, eating old World War II rations. One such person is Steve Thomas. In his video he posted, one of many that he has, he reviews a tin of unopened Canadian Army rations from World War II. Why? Well, let's find out. Steve joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on the show. This is Steve 1989, or Steve Thomas. And
Yes, I document old military rations and occasionally get a chance to try some of them out if they're still edible. And with that old Canadian food container survival ration, we got a chance to see what I believe, at least, was the oldest chocolate ever eaten, and it was quite the experience.
Well, I got to ask, why did you start doing this?
Well, you know, it was a fascination that started when I was a kid. I always loved military stuff, and then I got into the whole military ration thing when I was, I believe, 8 years old. Yes, I was 8 years old. My dad came home from an Army and Navy store. They stopped that with my uncle, and he picked up a case of MREs, and I've been pretty much in love ever since. And, you know, I've just been buying these things for most of my life here, and, you know, I collect and occasionally document, you know, the opening and reviewing and occasional taste testing of, you know, various military rations, some old, some new, some kind of old, like mid-90s, you know, some are, yes, World War II. I even have some Civil War hardtack that I'm planning on reviewing this year, and just at the right time, and I'm definitely excited to get that out there. Yes, 1863 or so, Civil War hardtack, like old crackers, essentially. And, you know, this is an interesting, pretty much untapped in a lot of ways, documentation of history and food storage. And it's very important, I feel, for people to know that some of this stuff can last a lot longer than what the expiration date can, you know, give you. So it's been quite the trip.
I understand the idea of people collecting things, because basically anything in this world is collectible to someone. So I get that part. The tasting is a little frightening to me. And I'm just wondering, since you collect, like for instance, the one I saw, as I mentioned in the introduction, you opened up a can of Canadian Army rations from World War II. Did you have more than one of them? And the reason I ask that is, does it lessen whatever value something has if you decide to open it and indeed eat it?
Oh, well, actually, I'd gotten that one as a duplicate from my good friend Sean Hayes, who is going to be opening up the first U.S.-based military ration museum. And Sean Hayes had a duplicate of that item, and he specifically wanted me to document it because it was never properly documented before. And yes, it does destroy the value of that specific specimen, but as long as there are duplicates of these rations and going to this museum that will be opened sometime this year, there's going to be a Kickstarter fundraiser campaign opening, starting up in early June. You know, it's one of those things. I feel that it's better being opened and documented than potentially just collecting dust on a shelf and not being known and enjoyed by the people. It's worth a lot more being known.
So when you opened one up and you tasted it, first of all, was there any concern on your part for your own health? I mean, you have things that are in that tin that are, you know, upwards of 70 years and more older. Were you worried about getting sick?
You know, as long as it passes the general visual, smell, and taste test, and a small taste starting, if it doesn't pass the visual, bulging cans, you know, obvious, any sort of rot or complete and utter degradation beyond, you know, say a swelling can could be botulism or, you know, there are slight risks past those basic steps. But for the most part, you know, If it passes the visual, smell, and taste test, it's edible. And I have not gotten sick from one video, from anything that I've documented on YouTube since I've started my channel, Steve1989 MRE Info, on YouTube last late November. So by following that visual, smell, and taste test, you know, touching a little bit at the tip of your tongue, if you're feeling a sharp, you know, rancidity or tinge or numbing, you don't eat it. And, you know, if it passes those three steps, then for me at least, and for what my body can handle, yes, it is edible. And no, I do not worry, because pretty much I know what I'm doing here, and if If it ends up getting the best of me one day, I feel like it's a risk worth taking.
Do you have some sort of control group? And by that I mean, have you had the opportunity to talk to anyone who may have gone through World War II or have eaten similar rations in a wartime situation to find out if this thing has held up? In other words, it may taste bad now. Did it taste just as bad then? Or has it lost any of its quality over the years of being unopened?
Excellent question, Peter. You know, that Canadian food container specifically was hated by every single Canadian soldier that documented. Most of those guys didn't remember any of the other rations they ate. You see, they're asking questions, any documentation of it. It's like, so, you know, guys, what'd you eat back then? Well, I don't really remember. It was just canned food. Well, what about that one survival ration? Oh, yeah, I do remember that. And that was terrible. So that thing was widely hated and notorious for being a hated food item back then. And a lot of this, what they call tropical chocolate, which is chocolate that can endure tropical climates without melting, hot climates, you know, it tasted more like a dried potato or something opposed to a piece of chocolate. So I knew what I was getting myself into initially. And, you know, it's a lot more fun for the documentation of this historical item to be able to, I guess you could say, put on a show, so to speak, and be able to, you know, try and enjoy it at least. And, you know, it allows a much broader audience to watch it and actually pay attention to it. Otherwise, it's just a very benign documentation, and it's pretty boring. So you gotta get in there and dig in. Otherwise, it's just nobody's going to watch. And I wanted to make sure that people, you know, knew what this ration, along with all the other ones that I've documented, were. And, yes, you know, I have talked to plenty of veterans, you know, and they're like, oh, I remember eating that. Oh, it wasn't much better when I had it. Or, oh, it was so much better. It just depends on which specific item. And in that case, with the Canadian ration, it was hated back then, and it was definitely not a very good experience food palate-wise nowadays. So, if that answers that.
So you collect rations through the years. Have you seen the changes through the years of how these things are put together? Are the rations, for instance, today, I'm hoping the rations of today are much superior to what World War II and Korean vets were subjected to?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, sir. The menu variation and the food quality itself has definitely improved. They're so much more palatable, easier to prepare, and lighter weight containers that hold the food, as thermostabilized packaging actually stores the food for longer most of the time opposed to just standard canned food goods. And yes, it's much better. So for an example, say a beef brisket MRE is so much more palatable than, say, a Vietnam War era turkey loaf or ham and eggs chopped. I mean, the food has certainly improved over the years.
So do you think someone who was collecting this stuff 70 years from now will be able to eat an MRE from today and enjoy it more than you are enjoying the World War II ones right now?
Yes, sir, I do believe so, and especially if the storage conditions were, you know, utmost. So what I mean by that is I actually had an MRE, actually several MREs, that were stored they were frozen for 20 years. And by being frozen, they didn't degrade at all. And it was absolutely incredible opening up a 1993 barbecue pork, pulled pork, essentially. It was pork and rice, excuse me, with barbecue sauce. And I actually had one of those when I was, I believe, 8 or 9 years old. It's one of the first MREs I had. It was a case of 93s, and this was a 1993 that I had just a couple months ago. And even the applesauce, it looked like it just came fresh out of the jar, opposed to being oxidized and black like a lot of them are. So if stored properly, yes, they will be just as good now as they were when originally packaged. But if they're not stored properly, you know, say if they're just in a hot, humid, bright 80 degrees constant, or even worse, fluctuating from cold to hot back and forth throughout the years, no, they're going to be just as bad as those World War II rations are now. The MREs will be, you know, 70 years from now. if even worse, potentially these thermostabilized packages can swell and fill up with botulism, essentially, and they'll just eventually burst. You know, so it just all depends on storage conditions.
Okay, I got less than a minute. I got to ask you this question, and you just very quickly give me the answer. In all the MREs you've eaten and the K-rations, what's the best thing you've ever tasted, and what vintage was it? And what's the worst thing you've ever tasted, and what vintage was that?
That's a very good question. You know, the best thing I ever tasted would probably be a Dutch lentils and beef, a Dutch military ration, Dutch MRE, and the absolute worst thing I ever had would have to be a halal MRE fag coal with lamb. That was definitely the worst thing I've ever had, and that was a new ration. So, but actually, no, you know what? Come to think of it, Ukrainian rations are the worst. I just remembered. That was definitely the worst.
Wow.
Come to think of it.
Well, you've got a more adventurous palate than I do. People can find your YouTube page. What is the YouTube handle again?
Steve1989 MRE Info. You can just type in Steve1989, and I'm right at the top there. And, yeah, check out my channel. I have over 60 videos, and I'll be adding more routinely and documenting everything from Civil War era. Like I'd mentioned, I have Civil War hardtack, and it'll be all the way up to modern 2016 rations. So keep your eye out, stay tuned, and thanks so much, Peter, for having me on.
Stephen Thomas, known online as Steve1989 MRE Info. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0352, and you'll find links to his YouTube page.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Jesus Cow, plus Stuart Nelman is along with another edition of Book Banter here on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And just a quick note before we get back to the Stuff File news, we love to hear from you at the Stuff File program. Send me an email with your thoughts or questions about the show and we'll respond. Just email me at peter@thestufffile.com. That's peter@thestufffile.com. Some of the questions might even make it onto the air in our mailbag section. Also, Facebook users, we urge you to join the Stuff File Facebook fan page. That's right. It's easy to find. It's at facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. We'd love to have you on as part of the fun on the Stuff File page. I mean, the more the merrier. And remember, as I said earlier, the show is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. So now, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? A man called attention to himself as he sped into a parking lot at the Placer County, California courthouse, parked in a reserved lot, taking up two parking spaces, by the way, and ran inside, apparently trying to make it to his court date on time. Sheriff's deputies, who watched it all, waited for him to finish his business inside and then confronted him when he returned to his car. They found the man had been driving with a suspended license, and because he was on probation, they searched the car and found marijuana packaged for sale, hash, scales, and other paraphernalia. To top it off, they determined the man was high on meth. Oh, but wait. The 47-year-old man is named Thomas Edward Weed. Yes, Thomas Edward Weed. No, really. And it gets better. He's a resident of the city of, wait for it, Grass Valley. He was arrested on multiple charges and jailed. A double name freak like that couldn't happen again in 100 years. Yeah. Oh, did I just say that the double name thing couldn't happen again in 100 years? Perhaps I spoke too soon. Police in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, yes, Pottstown, Pennsylvania, were dispatched to a hotel in town for a welfare check. A woman, her family said, was a heavy drug user and could be harming herself. Sure enough, when officers got to her room, she opened the door with a syringe in her hand and a pill bottle hanging out of her bra. Between the pill bottle and the bed, they found 67 bags of heroin packaged for sale, drug paraphernalia, and cash that investigators said was consistent with street-level drug sales. Arrested and jailed was 28-year-old Sarah High. Sarah High from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. You know, perhaps when she gets out of jail, if she still wants to stay in Pennsylvania, I suggest that Sarah High leave Pottstown and take up residence in another Pennsylvania community. New Hope would be a good one. Cokeburg, not so much so. Yeah. Officials say a former Endeavor Air flight attendant is charged with stealing nearly 1,500 mini bottles of liquor from her job and selling them online. The Shelby County District Attorney's Office said 28-year-old Rachel Trevor has been indicted on charges including theft, unlawful sale of alcohol, and unauthorized transportation of alcohol. Tennessee Alcohol Beverage Commission investigators say Trevor would put the small bottles of rum, vodka, gin, and whiskey in her bag after a flight, then post them for sale on Craigslist. Investigators said the bottles typically sell for $8 on flights, but Trevor sold them for $1 apiece. Endeavor Air is a regional affiliate of Delta Airlines. Now, how do people openly selling contraband on Craigslist not think they're going to get caught? You might as well stand on a street corner with a bullhorn and try to sell alcohol. And okay, so here's another winner. An Arkansas man has been arrested after police say he had 134 pounds of marijuana shipped from Mexico to his home. Jonesboro Police Department spokesman Paul Holmes said officers posed as delivery company employees and arrested 52-year-old Alberto Gomez Reyes after he signed for the package containing the marijuana. Police say he had the officers place it in the back of his truck. Gomez Reyes has been charged with possession of marijuana with the intent to deliver. Again, having drugs delivered from across the border through a courier company is not like getting your prescriptions delivered to you from the pharmacy. You're gonna draw attention to yourself. Seriously. Yeah. Anyway. We have one more story to share with you in our Stuff File News segment here before we get to our next guest. A Massachusetts man accused of locking a Verizon worker inside an unventilated underground vault because he was upset the worker parked on his grass has pleaded guilty to kidnapping. Howard Cook Jr. entered the plea in Worcester Superior Court. The 73-year-old Cook was sentenced to a year of probation and ordered to complete an anger management program. And by the way, when you're 73 years old, like Howard Cook Jr. is, I think the time has come to stop using Junior. Anyway, authorities said the retired utility official locked Michael Hathaway in the vault in August of 2013 by pulling out the extension ladder, locking the hatch, and placing large rocks on top. The ventilation system automatically shuts off when the door is closed. Police said Cook was upset that Hathaway parked on the grass at his business. Hathaway used his cell phone to call police. Gee, that would be a great commercial for Verizon. Hey, I'm in the vault. Can you hear me now? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Michael Perry is a New York Times bestselling author, humorist, and radio show host from Wisconsin. We had him on our old radio show back in the day. His bestselling memoirs include Population 485, Truck, A Love Story, Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting, and Visiting Tom. Last year, he released The Jesus Cow. It's now coming out in paperback. The book is described as a comic yet sincere exploration of faith in the face of the modern world. Michael joins us on the line right now from Wisconsin. Hi, Michael.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, you bet.
You have turned basically your company, which is known as Sneezing Cow, into a cottage industry with all the things that you have done. Where did the Jesus Cow come from?
You know, the Jesus Cow was the product of about a decade of reflection, I guess, and it in one part it comes from my childhood, and I was raised in an obscure fundamentalist Christian sect, and that always sounds kind of weird and makes people nervous, which is kind of fun, but it was actually a very gentle existence, but it was unusual, and I'm now just, I always describe myself as a bumbling agnostic, but despite the fact that I left that faith, I still know many of the people in it. I'm not a bitter heretic or anything like that. I'm just a guy that's moved to a different place. And so the idea of faith has continued to be central to my life. And then on a lighter note, many years ago, I used to do some writing in a coffee shop in Nashville, Tennessee, called Bongo Java. And when you went to pay for your coffee, there in a tiny little illuminated shrine beside the cash register was a cinnamon bun that was said to resemble the face of Mother Teresa. And what I always say is that it did kind of look like Mother Teresa, although it helped if you knew ahead of time. And they called it the nun bun, and they sold nun bun t-shirts and coffee mugs, or at least they did until they were asked to stop doing that by Mother Teresa's legal representation. But somewhere in between there, I got fascinated with the idea of what would happen if a guy in a small town in the rural Midwest had a cow that on Christmas Eve night had a little calf, and the spots on the side of the calf could be construed to be the image of Christ. And, of course, this isn't all that unusual. It's based on something called pareidolia, which is a neurophysiological thing where your eyes and brain want to make sense out of whatever they see, and so, you know, it's very common to see images going around the internet of someone sees the face of Christ in a grilled cheese sandwich or sees the Virgin Mary in some spots on some drywall. And so it was just my attempt to take that idea and turn it loose on the page and see what happened.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've written several memoirs, you've written several works which are fact-based in realism. This is the first time you've written something that is fictional.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I find interesting about that, and I think it's counterintuitive, most of my work, as you said, has been autobiographical, nonfiction memoir, writing about real people and real places. And I get asked a lot, does anyone ever get upset about what you write? And the honest answer is that yes, occasionally someone does. But I've always maintained that that is a much larger problem actually for novelists who work in fiction than it is for nonfiction. And as I said, it's counterintuitive, but at least when you write nonfiction, which is what I do most of the time, people know if you're talking about them or not. That's pretty clear. When you write fiction, the joke I always make is that when your mom calls in tears saying, why do you write all these terrible things about me? And you go, Mom, it's not you. It's a made-up character. She says, oh, yes, it is me. So there's this issue with fiction where people just, I guess I never really understood the word projection until I started writing fiction. And people see themselves in characters that may have had nothing to do with them at the inception. But the one thing I did enjoy about the fiction was really just letting the story roll wherever it took me. Obviously, with nonfiction, you pay close attention to facts and try to verify things and follow the timeline of reality. And so it was fun with the book, The Jesus Cow, to just give this guy, this quiet bachelor in a small Midwestern town, this unusual calf, and then just see what happened. At first, he tries to keep it quiet because he doesn't want to make a scene, as he says, but then he realizes it might be the chance to make money and save his farm, and he gets an agent from L.A., and after that, the things get a little more complicated.
So I think what you're saying is the story says more about, you know, beware of agents from L.A.
Yes. Yeah, there's a scene. I actually know an agent, not from L.A., but from New York, and I wrote a scene just for that agent, because when you first meet the agent, he's standing in fancy boots, but he's standing inside a manure spreader. And there's a line in the book about why it's not a big deal for an agent to stand in a pile of what goes in a manure spreader.
You mentioned this was an opportunity for you to take a story and see where it goes. As far as your writing process is concerned, do you know when you're sitting down to write a book like The Jesus Cow, the beginning, middle, and the end of the story, or are you learning the story as you write?
I'm very scattered. Writing is very difficult for me, at least in the process. I come from a family of farmers and loggers, so anytime I say writing is difficult, I always think of my brother inviting me to help him go out in the woods and log when it's 20 below. But as far as the process, yeah, I'm very scattered. And matter of fact, I've got a website, sneezingcow.com, and in there, there are photos in some of the posts about writing that show my process, which is I write copious amounts of notes, then I cut them up with the scissors, I lay them out all over the floor, I move them around on big long tables. I do whatever it takes to just try to get them to stick together. And I don't tend to write in a straight line. I tend to write scenes and then try to put it all together to make sense in the revision process.
So an open...
I cannot recommend it as a way to work, but it's the only thing that works for me.
Well, I was about to say, an open window and a breeze would be death for you.
It has actually happened. I'm speaking to you right now from, I guess you'd call it my writing office. We live out on a farm in rural Wisconsin, and I have a little room over the top of our garage, which is where I write. And today just so happens to be a nice day, so I've got screens open on both ends of the room. And I have actually, yes, had all those little pieces of paper wind up in one corner of the room at one time or another.
You write a lot of stuff with humor in mind, and again, this is a work of fiction, but there are people out there who don't have a sense of humor. Have you had any backlash about the book and the idea of the title, The Jesus Cow?
Well, you know what? Not a lot. Some. There was, when the hardcover came out, I know out in Seattle, someone protested the book, wrote a letter to the library demanding that it be pulled from the shelves based solely on the title. In that case, the librarian just said no. I always joke that two things about that. One is that tells you about librarians. They are strong and have a spine. And then on the more facetious front, they say I was terribly disappointed because, you know, a guy would hope maybe there'd be some big protests that might have sold some books. But yes, I have had a few people write to me. I've also actually, some of my, I don't like the word fans, but loyal readers of my other work have not read this book because they're not comfortable with the idea of someone having poking fun at faith. And it's a shame because if you read the book, it's actually all sides. I mean, one of the main characters is someone of quiet faith who just tries to do the right thing. And on the other hand, I've always said I reserve the right to find humor in all things, religions included, and I get nervous when religions have no sense of humor.
Is part of the problem timing? Because it seems to be a difficult time period for all religions, basically. Everyone's walking around on eggshells when it comes to religions, be they religious or not.
Yes, I think things are a little more tense than usual, and it's interesting to observe from the perspective of someone like me who was raised a fundamentalist Christian now is, you know, I'd have to say, for instance, I was just having a conversation with a friend the other day. I'm the kind of guy who says, when people ask me about the Bible, I say, well, man, study the life of Christ. He's just this supreme example of how we should try to treat each other. I think when it goes off the rails is when we start trying to be exceed our mortal powers and declare how everyone else should live. And, you know, for me, it comes down to three things. I care, first of all, how you treat my family. Second of all, how you treat my neighbors. And then lastly, how you treat me, and irrespective of your religion. But yes, it's a, you know, I think part of it is the ability for people everywhere to communicate with each other that, again, this will be the second time I use the word in the interview, so maybe you have to shut me off, but counterintuitively, all that communication, in theory, should be a good thing, but it has also uncovered a lot of ugliness.
And, well, you know,
I don't know, I guess, go ahead.
Being someone who is religious, I've always used the theory that you have to be religious, you have to have faith. And if you have faith, the very meaning of that means that if people talk or joke about your religion, it shouldn't bother you because you have faith.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it's also why I enjoy discussing this. It's funny, I've gotten a lot of, we talked about some of the negative feedback I've gotten, but I receive many emails and communication from pastors and ministers, some of whom have even quoted the book in their sermons, and I love that because we can have these discussions. That's why I always make it a point, as I did earlier, to say I'm a guy who left the faith, but I'm not angry, I'm not bitter. The example I always use is, my parents, who meet the description of fundamentalist Christians, nonetheless emphasized two things to us throughout our lives, and that was that was charity and humility. And I have watched them live that life, and what I say is that I can no longer pretend that I believe what they believe, but I try every day to be more like them. So.
Well, the idea of reading your book in a sermon is just the first step to later on seeing the Jesus cow in stained glass.
There you go.
Michael, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. People can check out your website, sneezingcow.com. And I thank you for being on the show with us once again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I always enjoy it.
Michael Perry, author of The Jesus Cow. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0352, and you'll find links to Michael's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Here's an interesting question. If you send a text message to someone while they're driving and they cause a crash, should the injured person or their family be able to sue you? Two men in Pennsylvania have been sued after sending text messages to a driver who became distracted and struck and killed a motorcyclist. The judge is letting the case move forward, and personal injury lawyers around America are closely watching this because of the precedent it could set. However, when a similar case made it to court in 2012, a judge dismissed it, saying that it was the driver's responsibility to ignore such distractions. Let's be fair, it makes sense to hold drivers responsible for accidents they cause, but it's another thing to sue someone who wasn't even in the car. As one judge said, drivers are bombarded with many forms of distraction, and if he allowed a lawsuit against the person who sends a text message, lawsuits could then be filed against anyone who creates a distraction for drivers, like putting a sign by a side of a road. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And with all the razzmatazz of flipping pages, once again, here is Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Razzmatazz. I mean, when I think about it, I think I should be in some jazz club, you know, in New Orleans circa 1930 or something like that.
It's hard to turn the pages when you have jazz hands.
Yeah, but that wasn't documenting Ken Burns' documentary, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, this edition of Book Banter, yes, we're going to have a little razzmatazz aspect of entertainment history, because you know what? There are three main cornerstones in the American entertainment world. There's Hollywood, of course, Nashville, also known as the Music City, and New York City, especially the Broadway Theater District. Now, over the past 50 years, the Broadway of Irving Berlin, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, Mary Martin, and Ethel Merman had seen its share of triumphs, setbacks, and tragedies. And when there were times that it looked like Broadway would collapse into obscurity, shows like A Chorus Line, Cats, Phantom of the Opera, The Lion King, and Up, and recently Hamilton, would come around and snatch it from the jaws of that imminent collapse. And during those 50 years, the struggles to keep Broadway alive and relevant, especially when it was butting heads with the city of New York and its municipal administration, would sometimes provide more drama than what was being offered on stage in many of its historical theaters along the Great White Way. Now, Michael Riedel, who's a theater columnist for the New York Post, has been a keen observer of the Broadway theater scene for over 20 years, and he brings his passion for the American theater and its famous home on Broadway, not to mention its countless demises and rebirths, in an immensely readable backstage account called Razzle Dazzle. Now, the main characters of this book is, there are two people, Bernard Jacobs and Gerald Schoenfeld. They're just two New York lawyers who were hired by the Schubert Organization in the 50s to just basically look after the organization because one of the main Schuberts, JJ, was in rapid decline.
You're not telling us the plot of the movie The Producers, are you?
No.
Okay.
Because, these two guys, far cry from Bialystok and Bloom, they made hits. Yeah, they had some flops too, but they made hits and they made money from those hits.
Yeah, but don't forget, Springtime for Hitler was a hit, technically.
Yes, but they want it to be a flop, don't forget.
Yes.
Now, when J.J. Schubert died in 1963, Jacobs and Schoenfeld took over the Schubert Organization and subsequent Schubert Foundation and quickly became the most powerful men on Broadway. Now, the turbulent directorship of Messrs. Schoenfeld and Jacobs didn't end, there when they took over from the Schubert Organization. There were other events that colored this new era, such as good old boy Irving Goldman, who managed he finagled a $1 million contract for his paint company, with the Schuberts, and somehow, for some strange reason, was appointed as New York's cultural commissioner, just by running a paint business. Gee. Then
Is that one or two coats?
Probably lots of coats.
Okay.
Probably a shellacking on the side too.
Maybe even a coat of many colors.
Oh yes. With apologies, Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Exactly.
Then there's how Broadway handled the growing AIDS crisis of the 1980s, the bitter rivalry between Dreamgirls and Nine to see who would win the most Tony Awards in 1982, the fearful, powerful influence of New York Times drama critic Frank Rich, who was able to make or break a new show with the stroke of a pen or a few clicks of a typewriter key, I guess. Not to mention all the power plays, bruised egos, hurt feelings, and vindictive reactions that went along with it.
It and opened at 8 p.m. sharp and closed at 9:30 dull.
Which didn't happen in Springtime for Hitler.
No.
No. I think probably Spider-Man, actually.
Oh, man. Yeah, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Wow.
But look at the end result of all the above, okay? And more, because That's basically reported in the book, because it affected Broadway, it really affected the Broadway world today. But look what happened. By the end of the 2000s, an average of 12 million people saw a Broadway show every year, with an annual box office gross of over $1 billion. And Broadway theaters and its offshoots contribute these days to 11% of the entire economic output of New York City.
Wow.
You couldn't say that 40 years ago when New York was on the brink of bankruptcy, that's for sure.
That's for sure indeed.
Oh yeah, and Hamilton will probably bring it up to a new level.
It already has. I think it passed a milestone in revenue just recently.
Yeah, and you still can't get tickets to that show.
No,
not if you have all the biggest connections, on Broadway. Still can't get one.
I don't think members of the crew can get tickets anymore.
No, I think you're better off reading Ron Chernow's biography. But in essence, Razzle Dazzle is probably one of the best books about Broadway's illustrious yet sometimes flawed history. It's a penetrating look at how two unlikely people with a passion for the theater fought tooth and nail over the past 50 years to keep the Broadway theater scene to its legendary glory and to make sure that the lights on the Great White Way were never dimmed at all.
And the book is?
It's called Razzle Dazzle, and it's by Michael Rydell. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $34.99.
And what else do you recommend, perhaps in a similar vein?
Well, we got, if you want to read a good legitimate history of Broadway, I recommend a book which is called Broadway by legendary theater critic Brooks Atkinson. It was published in 1970 and it's been revised several times. It's probably one of the definitive histories of the Broadway theater from the 1800s up to the present. A lot of great old pictures. It's a really thorough history. I read it in 1980 and it was still fascinating books. Like I said, great old pictures. It's amazing what kind of plays were on Broadway about 100 years ago. And the musical that we know it now didn't come to pass until about 1943. And also, I recommend a memoir called Rewrites by Neil Simon. If you want to know about how Neil Simon became the legendary Broadway playwright from, starting from, your show of shows back in the 50s to, writing The Odd Couple, it's an excellent memoir. It's one of my favorites.
Excellent. And again, this week's book is?
It's called Razzle Dazzle by Michael Rydell, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $34.99.
And how can people find you? Are you on the boards, Mr. Snowman?
No, but you could remember me to Herald Square, the Montreal Times, every week in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Well, thank you, Peter. Now, before the curtain goes down, I'm going to make my final bow and say thank you very much.
Thank you. Encore. Encore.
Yes. Yes. Author, author.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming up in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Politely holding a door open for a police officer has landed a Massachusetts man in jail. Kayvon Madivat was at the Natwick Mall when he held the door open for the leaving officer. Now, that officer thought Mavidat looked familiar and went to check his cruiser's computer. The officer found there were 3 warrants out for his arrest for heroin possession, shoplifting, and driving on a suspended license. Because apparently all criminals drive on suspended license. The officer returned to the mall and arrested Mavidat. The 28-year-old was held without bail at his arraignment when his probation officer told the judge he routinely skips court dates, court-appointed or court-ordered drug tests, and fails to pay probation fees. Mavidat's lawyer argued for release, saying he has a job now and can pay those fees. What, no time off for politeness? I mean, he's a nice young man. He held the door open. Anyway, let's get to the final story of the day on this program. You know what it is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
61-year-old James Kane of rural Sarasota County, Florida, called 911 to report that an intruder had been shot and killed. Self-defense, he said. Now, James was on his own property, and I think it's very important to state that he was on his own property. He claimed 35-year-old Jason W. Head had shot at his son, 32-year-old Robert, and Robert returned fire, killing Head. Sarasota County Sheriff's deputies investigating the killing noticed the property had security cameras. Not working, they were told. The cops insisted on seeing the system, and sure enough, they worked just fine. We basically saw most of the incident that happened that night, said Lieutenant Joe Giassone, including Kane and Robert chatting over Head's dead body and then putting a gun in his hand to show that he had been a threat. Then it shows 27-year-old Raquel Pombrillon driving up and picking up Robert. She is Head's former girlfriend. All three have since been arrested. James Kane as principal to second-degree murder, Robert for second-degree murder with a firearm, and Pobrillon for accessory after the fact. Now, why, oh why, would you commit such a crime in your own home when you have to know that you have security cameras on your property, which for some reason you've neglected to disengage? Then you tell the police they're not working, which no cop in their right mind is going to take your word for it, thus leaving your entire sordid plot to unfold like a bad MSNBC documentary? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0352. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0352. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.